Hello, and welcome to Fathoming Water. I'm your host, Melissa Mosey. In our last episode, we talked with Juliet McKenna of Montgomery & Associates. I appreciate her sharing her experience in the world of private water consulting. She spoke of her experience in various states, not just Arizona. Her point that states within the U.S. are very different when it comes to water management and policy leads us to this week's episode. This week, we talked to Zach Sugg. Zach has worked extensively in Texas and Arizona, so he is able to expand on that concept and get us into the nitty-gritty of how states' water management policies, especially concerning groundwater, can vary wildly. Zach Sugg is a PhD candidate in the School of Geography and Development at the University of Arizona, and is a water resource geographer researching groundwater governance with a focus on the western U.S. His education and experience are centered around water governance, including the history of groundwater law and policy, political economy of water, rural-urban environmental issues in the American West, as well as applications of GIS and remote sensing for management of freshwater resources. Zach was the lead author of Conjunctive Groundwater Management as a Response to Socio-Ecological Disturbances, a comparison of four Western U.S. states, published in the Texas Water Journal. And Zach was also a visiting scholar at Texas State University. In this episode, we cover a lot of ground. Zach was one of my fellow cohort in graduate school, and we shared advisors and classes. One of the draws of a geography degree is it encourages a student to focus on different parts of the world and draws contrast and comparisons to other regions. And in this episode, we do just that. Zach and I talk about how groundwater is managed both in Arizona and Texas, and explore the disconnect between surface water and groundwater management. Instead of, like in Arizona, the Central Arizona Project and the Arizona Department of Water Resources managing the majority of water resources in Arizona, Texas has over 100 different water conservation districts that manage water, but typically have no regulatory teeth. This is because, unlike Arizona, groundwater is private property in Texas, and any restriction on its use can be legally viewed as a regulatory taking. Texas being a country unto itself at one point in history means that its rules surrounding water are affected by the laws and traditions established during Texas's autonomy from the United States. With a history that involves Mexico, the Confederacy, and the evolving laws of the United States comes a unique set of political jurisdictions that shape the water management of the state. But nature plays a hand, too. The unique ecology and hydrology of the Edwards Aquifer in San Antonio forces the state to establish an even more unique set of rules governing the management of water for that specific and special aquifer. San Antonio is experiencing sprawl, and in this case, the sprawl means managing more than just one aquifer, but different aquifers, different water conservation districts, and different political jurisdictions. The Edwards Aquifer Authority acts as more of a regulatory agency than the districts, but the complexity of the state's water laws leads to more conflict and lawsuits, as we will see. Zach and I compare Arizona's top-down management with Texas's bottom-up management and the strengths and weaknesses of each. In his dissertation research, he is examining the contrast between San Antonio and Phoenix and takes into account many factors such as public drought awareness, water markets, local connection to water authorities, and ease of access to power. And we get to touch on each of these in this interview. And now, Zach Sugg. I'm sitting here with Zach Sugg today. Let's first talk about Texas. That was the first area you studied. How is Texas groundwater managed?
It's managed mostly at the local level. There are roughly 100 groundwater conservation districts. And they are in charge of setting rules about how much water people can pump, what the management goal is going to be, and they're sort of distributed over the majority of the state. So there is no state agency that is in charge of regulating everybody's groundwater pumping, which is different than in Arizona and most other states that have a state water agency whose job it is to regulate the use of the resource.
There's no water agency in Texas, or is there one that regulates surface water?
There is, yeah. So Texas, like Arizona, has separate systems for surface water and groundwater. So groundwater is private property, surface water governed under the rule of prior appropriation. So basically first come, first serve, the kind of classic ownership doctrine for most Western states. And so there are state agencies that deal with both surface water and groundwater. It's just that the one in charge of groundwater doesn't actually regulate the resource. They do modeling, they do studies, and various other activities, but they do not regulate individual groundwater pumping.
Does the state agency communicate with them on how much water they're using?
Yeah, definitely. It's called the Texas Water Development Board. So where the development board comes in and plays a big role is in the they have a periodic planning process where they have to figure out what their future management goals are going to be for the aquifer all over the state. They're called desired future conditions, and there's some sort of determination of how much water we want to have available in the aquifer at future date X, you know, say 30 years in the future or something like that. And so the way they figure out what the number is of the amount of groundwater that they can permit in the meantime and achieve that goal is by doing various model runs. And so the development board helps out the districts by doing a lot of the technical work that the groundwater districts don't do. The development board has the models developed for all the different aquifers in the state. And so they take the management goals, run various scenarios.
The conservation districts, can they regulate people's individual wells? Can the conservation district go to a ranch owner and say, you need to use less groundwater?
Sort of. That's where it gets complicated in Texas because, okay. And this is, again, related to the issue of groundwater being private property. A lot of the controversy right now in Texas is to sort out the extent to which these districts can limit people's groundwater pumping. Or, for example, if somebody requests a permit for X amount of groundwater and the conservation district says, well, we think that's an amount that exceeds our sustainable management objectives, we're going to grant you X percentage of what you asked for. Because of the whole private property situation, the person who applied for the permit can then file suit against the district claiming that a regulatory taking, which is a legal term, that comes up in other aspects of government, state regulation of other types of private property. So
okay.
They can actually sue the districts.
Does that happen frequently?
It's starting to happen. There are cases going on right now, which were just getting going in the sort of central Texas area where I was studying, around Austin, San Antonio, that area. There's kind of an unclear line between what is a lawful regulation of individuals' groundwater pumping and a regulatory takings.
What is the Surface Water Agency?
TCEQ, Texas Commission on Environmental Quality. So they regulate both quality and quantity of surface water. They have their own separate water models that they use to analyze water availability.
Does that create problems if they're using different modeling on recharge when it comes to surface water recharge? Because that's really where the loop would be, where you're missing that kind of link.
Yeah, that's a good question. I know that there is sort of a recognition of a need to have the models be more integrated. But the sort of bifurcation of the two types of water, which is obviously like a total fiction, is kind of inhibits that. So these agencies are siloed and it's hard for them to sort of plan water as one coherent entity. And especially problematic because in a lot of parts of Texas, groundwater and surface water are very intimately connected to each other. And so I think that's recognized as an issue going forward, that the two need to be managed conjunctively rather than separately. But I think there's a lot of work still to do to get to that point.
What is the history of the development of these two water boards and the conservation districts?
Well, they were created, I can't remember specifically what year they were created, but you know, a long time ago in the early 1900s, Texas passed legislation that said the state has a right to impose rules about the conservation of water. So these agencies were created, although not given a ton of regulatory authority, but they do have the ability to regulate on behalf of sort of the common good. And this was in response to like devastating droughts. So people said, well, we would like for the state to have the authority to conserve the natural resources. But the devil's really kind of in the details.
I'm assuming the first resource that was managed was the surface water, and then the groundwater was the secondary?
Yeah, that's right.
In time? Okay.
Yeah, and then Texas is interesting because the surface water, Texas people have been living in Texas for a very long time, and it's been under different political jurisdictions over time. And so there are, they've had to sort of reconcile various surface water rights that even predate statehood for Texas.
Oh, interesting.
Similar to California and other places where, for example, like Spanish colonial settlements had existed and things like that. But groundwater does come on much later in the grand scheme of things.
Just because pumping at the levels we do now was unheard of before.
Yeah, it was the technology didn't exist.
So it was really the development of the technology that ended up in developing the laws surrounding groundwater.
Right, exactly. The electrification of rural, the Great Plains in the western U.S. was a big factor because once you had electricity after the Depression era, then you had power that you could use to run more high-volume irrigation pumps.
Okay.
Rest before, the technology wasn't there.
What is the majority of groundwater that is pumped in Texas used for?
The majority, like in most states, is for agriculture.
So most urban areas are using surface water, treated surface water, or are they also somewhat dependent on groundwater?
It just depends what city it is. So
okay,
if you think about Texas, it's right on the 100th meridian, that climatic kind of divider line. And in the east side of the state, it's much more humid. And so there's more reservoirs and surface water for the cities. But as you go west, there are fewer and fewer surface water bodies. So then it sort of depends. San Antonio is an example of a city that is probably the most reliant on groundwater historically. So somewhere around 90% of their municipal supply historically had come from one individual aquifer, which is Edwards Aquifer.
And what is the condition of that aquifer now?
Well, they've passed a lot of regulations after a lot of fighting, legal fighting over how to regulate it.
Within that conservation district.
Yeah, well, so the Edwards Aquifer is really kind of a unique entity within the world of all these individual local districts because it's more like a full-fledged regulatory agency.
Oh, really? Okay.
In charge of one particular aquifer. And this is related to lawsuits that went on in the 90s. Sierra Club filed suit under the Endangered Species Act because it's a very unique kind of aquifer system in that it functions more like a conveyor belt. Like, so water enters in one region, percolates into the aquifer, and then it moves relatively quickly through the formation and comes out through springs that then form streams that eventually run all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. And so there are endangered species who live in this sort of unique ecosystem that depend on a minimum amount of flow coming out of the aquifer through the springs. And so the whole issue was, what was the overpumping of the aquifer and there not being enough water for these endangered species during drought years? It was a lot to do with who and how you could regulate the use of that aquifer, because there was actually a groundwater district in charge of it previous to all these lawsuits, but it had very little regulatory power. It was weak. So it was a really obvious situation where you have groundwater and surface water connected in a very obvious kind of way, but institutionally a very prohibitive, complicated and setting. And so the lawsuit was about trying to force the hand of the state to actually do something to regulate the aquifer, because again, private property, they're not exercising their regulatory authority to limit the pumping of the aquifer. It's sort of a story of moving from a lack of recognition of the connection between surface and groundwater to a much more nuanced and a much better recognition of the connection, because now they're managed, the aquifer and the springs are managed in a much more kind of holistic way.
But it's only at this one conservation district level. It's not, that has not occurred in other areas of the state.
Definitely not to the extent of the Edwards Aquifer.
Of the Edwards Aquifer. It's a unique case.
So the aquifer was regulated following all these lawsuits. So the judge said, Texas, you have to regulate the aquifer. So they create this entity, the Edwards Aquifer Authority, in charge of, you know, establishing a cap and withdrawals, an annual cap on the aquifer that they think is going to long-term, you know, avoid affecting the endangered species. And then later on, and this is much more recent, so that happened during the 90s. In more recent times, they've gone through another process, a multi-year stakeholder process, in order to establish a set of more kind of nuanced, holistic kind of management criteria, so based on various ecologic and hydrologic indicators. But to get to this, which is overseen primarily by the Edwards Aquifer Authority. But to get there, there was a huge, long process of stakeholder engagement where, you know, San Antonio and the Aquifer Authority and the people who are interested in maintaining spring flows, all the various interests had to agree on all of these measures to manage the aquifer and possibly put an end to the major conflict that had been going on.
Now, with Arizona groundwater, we've talked before in this podcast about the AMAs. At least give people a brief overview of Arizona's groundwater and how we're different than Texas.
Historically, groundwater in Arizona was not much different from the way it is and has been in Texas. So it was subject to also private ownership under the reasonable use doctrine, which is a virtually unlimited right to pump groundwater. And that eventually led to a lot of problems with overpumping in central Arizona by irrigation communities. And eventually, after lawsuits and some political wrangling, et cetera, Arizona eventually passed the Groundwater Management Act, which basically made groundwater a public resource rather than a private one. And so instead of individuals having an unlimited right to pump, they were then granted permits to pump by the state. The Groundwater Management Act only applies to specific management areas within the state.
The active
management areas, yeah.
AMAs.
So there's huge other parts of the state that are not covered by an active management area.
Did the Groundwater Management Act connect surface water and groundwater?
That's a good question. Arizona is in a similar situation as Texas in the sense that they also have separate legal doctrines for surface water and groundwater. Both Texas and Arizona apply a prior appropriation, first come, first serve, for surface water. And so historically, they've been governed separately. But over time, since the 90s, Arizona has done a lot of kind of interesting things with conjunctively managing surface water and groundwater, a lot to do with putting surface water that's not being used, excess surface water supplies, into the groundwater aquifers, storing them there to be used later on. Arizona's created some entities like the Arizona Water Banking Authority that does a lot of banking of surface water in various facilities around both in the Tucson area and in the Phoenix Metroplex, that management area, and elsewhere, central Arizona. And the whole idea is to provide some resilience and also a way to just actually use the amount of water that Arizona is legally entitled to, that 2.8 million acre feet. Historically, Arizona has not been able to use all of that water in a given year, because it didn't grow nearly to the extent or as fast as, for example, California, which gets a much bigger piece of the Colorado River, but blew through it much quicker than Arizona. So Arizona has had this sort of extra surface water. You know, they realize that it makes sense to use it to help them reduce the reliance on mined groundwater, overpumping groundwater. So it has allowed some flexibility to use different sources of water depending on the basic hydrologic conditions in a given year. So it gives them some flexibility during drought years, for example, things like that.
What are you working on specifically?
I'm specifically working on looking at these two governance systems using Phoenix and San Antonio sort of as my main case studies. So I'm interested in the comparison between decentralized governance using local districts and larger, a more sort of top-down approach, which is the way that Arizona decided to go. And what are the kind of pros and cons? How can you sort of associate different types of challenges, successes, et cetera, with the two different approaches? So I see them as kind of moving, as Texas at least, moving kind of more towards an Arizona type of model, but not totally going that way. So There's more of a bottom-up approach still, but what they've been doing in the last, I don't know, 10 or 15 years is trying to facilitate more kind of coordinated planning at the aquifer level. So getting, requiring the individual districts to work together more, establish sort of common management goals, common desired future conditions, and so that there's more kind of a cohesive management. Because the problem is, unlike in Arizona, the districts in Texas are based on largely political boundaries. So individual counties, most of them. So
oh,
they don't
okay.
conform to
the aquifer itself.
Hydrologic boundaries.
Okay.
No. Yeah, so they're usually either, most of them are either a county or sometimes agglomerations of counties. But in Arizona, they made the districts, the active management areas, conform to hydrogeologic boundaries.
Oh, so score for Arizona.
Yeah, it does make a little more sense, most people would say.
Now, with Phoenix, studying Phoenix, the Salt River Project has been one of the longest-lasting governmental institutions over water in the country. It's very unique. What role does the Salt River Project play? Because they mostly are dealing with surface water. What role do they play with the management of groundwater?
So I would say they play an important role in groundwater just by the fact that they do supply so much surface water. So most of the cities, major city of Phoenix, for example, they don't have to rely so much on groundwater because they get so much water from the Salt River Project. And so they have a relatively small, tiny fraction of groundwater that they actually pump.
Now, what about as you get further out into places like Maricopa and places that used to be agricultural land but have now become suburban areas?
Yeah, so this is what I'm particularly interested in, is what happens with water use outside of Salt River Project's jurisdiction. Mm. So areas with no surface water supply at all and who have to rely on groundwater. So, and I think this is, as Phoenix continues to sort of sprawl outwards, this is going to increasingly be a hot topic, I think. How do you manage the growth in these areas? The assumption is that they're being offset by replenishment of surface water in other parts of the basin, but people have issues with the extent to which that is actually happening.
Also, there was the idea that not using as much agricultural water would offset the use of the urban water.
Right.
Is that the case?
So the Groundwater Management Act was designed in part to encourage the replacement of irrigation farms with less water-consuming types of development. And so I think that has happened to some extent, because when you retire a farm, the amount of water that they are able, groundwater that they are able to pump is cut, so that there's not a net, so there's a reduction in the amount of groundwater that can be produced from that land. That's been one thing that they've tried, I think, that people thought the Groundwater Management Act would accomplish. And I think to some extent that it has, but I also, based on my interviews with people, with experts in the Phoenix area, that hasn't, the replacement of agriculture with urban, suburban development hasn't happened quite to the extent that the original writers of the act sort of thought it would.
It's so been greater?
So agriculture hasn't gone away nearly as fast as people thought it would, is my impression so far.
Oh, interesting. Now, does the San Antonio area have the same kind of sprawl issues that Phoenix is having?
It definitely, I would say it has a similar growth pattern.
It does.
Yeah. And I think it's typical of most sort of Sun Belt cities. And, you know, I grew up in Dallas, which is a classic sprawling out giant megalopolis. And you see when in situations where there's plenty of land and the land is cheap to develop on, there's no major incentive to make the cities more and more dense and to limit growth. And there's nobody limiting growth to existing cities. So, and then when gas is cheap and people don't mind commuting, they're more willing to live, I think, further away from the city center.
And has the water laws, one being top-down, one being bottom-up, has that changed how development happens around a city between the two, between Texas and Arizona?
That's a really good question. I'm hoping to have a better answer for you when I finish with my dissertation in a few months. I'm trying to, and that's where I want to go in my future research, is to sort of better link water policies to their effect on how growth actually happens, in patterns of growth, the type of growth that happens.
The development in San Antonio, has it been inhibited at all by the
Edwards
Aquifer governmental body.
Yeah, so this is the interesting thing that I'm trying to look at with the San Antonio area is that so the city of San Antonio does rely on the Edwards Aquifer for a huge percentage of its municipal supply.
Okay.
But in the areas that San Antonio is growing out into, these are areas that are not overlying the Edwards Aquifer. So these are overlying other aquifers that are adjacent to it. So there's a sort of mixture of local districts, individual local districts sort of all around San Antonio that border on the Edwards Aquifer's jurisdiction. And so what I'm looking at in my dissertation is not only the Edwards Aquifer District, but also a couple of them that are sort of in the path of growth as San Antonio sort of continues growing northwards into the Hill Country, which is a beautiful area. And people are moving out there in droves.
So between Austin and San Antonio?
Both between Austin and San Antonio and then just north. So if you think of Austin as roughly north of San Antonio, also the growth is happening sort of more northwest of San Antonio as well.
These homes that are farther out are the homes digging wells, creating their own water providers?
Definitely in the, when we talk about the exurbs, it's an area that sort of loosely connected to the city center. Once you're outside of the actual city, the rules can be very different. So if you're, you know, within the city, you're subject to all sorts of drought restrictions and...
Oh, you can't water your lawn on certain days or...
Yeah, San Antonio has gotten very good about public information and conserving water when there's a drought going on. I mean, they even have like billboards, you know, I've seen them downtown where they say what stage of drought, what level it is, so to get people to know, to think about...
Oh, that's fascinating.
How serious the drought is at any given moment. But if you're just outside of San Antonio and you're sort of beyond their water hookups, the situation is very different, and you might be served by a small municipal water supply, or you can also, you know, just have your own well. Because if your well is below a certain threshold, in most cases, it's exempt from regulation. So places you can just go sink a well, and even within the Edwards Aquifer, that's possible. If it's below a certain threshold, it's an exempt well. And that's an issue in Arizona, too. It's a challenge for the agencies who have to deal with it because it's hard to pin down exactly how much water is associated with the sort of totality of all the exempt wells.
Do you think that Texas being ground up versus Arizona being top down changes the way that you said that San Antonio, they have a great awareness of drought, they have a great education program, and people change their behavior based on drought? Do you see that happening because it's more bottom up, or do you see that happening in Arizona?
I think people in San Antonio are more aware of drought than people and other people even in Texas. But I think that's less to do with the way that the governance system is sort of organized and more to do with just the city of San Antonio being more proactive about trying to educate its citizens. In Phoenix, it might also be the case that it just depends on which particular city you happen to live in, whether it's Phoenix or Mesa or Glendale or whatever, what the particular sort of education activities of that city are.
Okay, so the education is really coming from the political organizations even outside of water governance bodies.
To some extent, yeah, I think so.
Okay.
They definitely play an important role. And in the case of Texas, you can see large differences between cities as far as the extent to which they are proactive about trying to get people to conserve their water. So San Antonio and El Paso are more widely known as being more proactive or on the ball about educating the citizens about water usage, whereas, you know, the gallons per capita per day usage in other cities like Dallas-Fort Worth, they also experience, you know, the impacts of drought, but they use per capita much more water than other cities like Tucson and San Antonio, El Paso.
So how would you evaluate in terms of top-down, bottom-up, which one appears to be more effective for maintaining groundwater aquifers?
It's a good question also. I think the Arizona example, because it was pretty innovative at the time. They've had a lot of success at reducing the amount of groundwater that's being pumped.
And with a top-down strategy.
Yeah, relatively top-down in the sense that the state agency who enforces regulations and administers all the permits and it does allow the decision making. In Texas, it's much more mixed because each district is sort of its own, to some extent, its own particular entity.
So it creates a patchwork. You could have
very much a patchwork,
aquifer management in one area and just terrible aquifer management in the
And there's various reasons why. Well, they have different goals, different management goals, different parts of the state. But yeah, so for example, in my particular case, I studied two local districts that were on the sort of north side of San Antonio in the path of growth. And one of them I found has more of a reputation for being more conservation minded and a little bit more strict in terms of deciding about permits, how much groundwater to be somebody can pump. Whereas the district that it was that was right next door to it, so these districts are created by the state legislature. So you pass a bill that creates a district and they can alter kind of the rules. The legislature can write the rules to make the district less or more regulatory authority. And so the other one next door to the one that I just mentioned has much less authority to regulate sort of urban pumping, almost to the extent that they're a district in a nominal district, you know, in name only. So they do very little. They have very little real regulatory authority.
And what does their aquifer look like? Is it overpumped or?
I don't think it's overpumped yet, but you know, it's an area where there's a lot of growth happening. And
so the risk is down the line.
Yeah. So,
and because it's based on political boundaries, you're also seeing that politics and the politics of the people that live within the district are shaping the way that water is used more than the government or some sort of governmental body shaping the use of the water.
Yeah, it's very kind of complicated, and there's other political considerations not even related to water going on that influence sometimes water policy, and it's interesting. Part of what they're trying to do is to have things more integrated, but I think in some cases having multiple districts that are basically neighbors but have different sets of rules and are written in the authorizing statutes differently, I think in the future could create some problems related to achieving sort of future management goals as demands continue to increase. Even if there's not an immediate, you know, threat long term, I can see it potentially becoming a problem. The patchwork nature of all the rules.
Eventually, though, because they often share aquifers.
Sure.
And cross aquifer lines. So as one depletes their aquifer more, the other one may sue the other agency. Could that happen where you would have?
I think that would be unlikely to have two districts attacking each other. But there are issues related to people trying to export groundwater from one district into another one, you know, so which is less of an issue if you just have one big, huge district like they have in Arizona.
Okay.
So it would not be an export to move, you know, groundwater from, you know, not a very far distance to transport it. But in Texas, it can be an issue if you're right on the border of a district.
Oh, so like a farmer could pump water from one district and then just pipe it across to fields on the other side of the district if he were...
In theory, yeah. It's much more of a complicated issue.
Are there exchanges? Are there groundwater exchanges between districts or between people? Is there any sort of market that is a result of this?
For sure, between people in our Edwards Aquifer, there's a market.
Oh.
Basically a cap and trade type situation, similar to like people talk about with carbon emissions trading or whatever. That was sort of the solution they arrived at when they decided to finally regulate the aquifer. They capped the aquifer and then they allocated permits and then made those permits transferable. So people can, farmers can sell or lease groundwater rights to other farmers or industry or to cities.
But these are all one-on-one exchanges.
They are one-to-one, but it's also overseen by, they have to be approved by the Edwards Aquifer Authority.
Okay.
So there is oversight. What I'm talking about is just people transferring groundwater rights, either on a permanent or temporary basis. But it's limited to the geographical
area
jurisdiction
of the
aquifer authority. If what you're after is, I think, a high volume of transfers, I think the Edwards Aquifer is probably a good example of that because they made the property rights relatively clear. Everybody knows exactly how much water they have a permit for. And then you can transfer that land, that water right, apart from your land. So what happens in a lot of cases is, what happened especially in the early days phase of the creation of the market is San Antonio was the major buyer. And so they were on the market actively looking for farmers who are willing to sell their water rights. And so they've obtained a chunk of their municipal supply that way over time, buying water rights here and there over time. But it's been a relatively active market, and there's been a lot of transfers from farmers to other farmers and also from farmers to growing urban areas. Yeah, so San Antonio, for example.
So what is the biggest lesson that Arizona could learn from the Texas situation?
Biggest lesson. I'm still kind of trying to sort this out for myself in my own head, but I think one thing that I keep coming back to is, so it's interesting that initially Arizona did have local offices in the active management areas, so that there was, you know, a local face of the agency that if you were, you know, nowhere near Phoenix where the agency's headquarters is, you had somebody you could go to with questions, to get help with paperwork, you know, all these sorts of things. And I think my impression from interviews that I've done is that the regulated users really liked that, having that kind of the local offices. Those are eventually shut down because the water agency's budget was cut massively.
So the Arizona Department of Water Resources?
Yes, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so those offices were shut down, and so now there's only one office in Phoenix. And so one thing that I think is not necessarily a lesson, because Arizona kind of sort of tried it and it didn't work out for political reasons, but people in these local districts in Texas that I've talked to, they really appreciate the local scale, like being able to easily go and talk with the managers who are determining who your permit application or trying to comply with the rules or whatever. People, especially in rural areas, okay, or people are ranchers, farmers, et cetera. No one wants to have to drive an hour or 2 hours into the city just for, you know, to do basic, you know, regulatory compliance type things. And basically everybody I talked to was happy that there is this sort of local face that they can talk to.
How are the conservation districts in Texas funded?
They're funded in a couple of different ways. Some of them are funded through taxes, and others are funded through user fees, I believe.
Okay.
Yeah.
Which allows a lot more flexibility for keeping these places open and keeping them local.
That's another point on which there's a lot of variation. So some of the districts are decently funded, I would say. Others are very poorly funded. And it has to do with, you know, it's sort of a similar issue to, you know, funding is always an issue, I think. It's a problem in Arizona with the state water agency. It's a problem in Texas with the local conservation districts as well.
Okay.
Because they're not, you know, funded by the state government doesn't send them a chunk of money. You know, they're funded by the local users, including people who don't really pump necessarily a bunch of groundwater in the case of tax-based districts.
Oh, so they could vote against a proposition to raise taxes to pay for it.
Yeah, and in some cases, at least in one district I was aware of in Central Texas, there's categorical opposition to the creation of a district on the basis of sort of a political opposition to having a tax imposed on them, because it's perceived as, well, another new tax by some people. And, you know,
and then the water resources in Arizona, the department is just funded through state taxes in general. So
yeah, their budget's dependent on the whims of the state legislature to a certain extent.
Okay. So there seems to be a tighter connection between people and how water is managed in their nearby area than there is in Arizona. In Arizona, a specific citizen would not worry about an increase in property tax or something like that for water management.
Yeah, they probably wouldn't be quite as, it's not a highly visible issue, I guess.
So there's a visibility difference. It's more visible in Texas and less visible in Arizona?
Yeah, it could be, at least for the people who care about groundwater or paying attention, and people who are vigilant about their taxes.
What could Texas learn from the Arizona story?
I think they could potentially learn from some of the conjunctive management approaches that Arizona has used. Also, I guess in some cases, maybe people, well, so some people would say that it would be better for groundwater to be regulated as a public resource, public good, rather than as private property. This has allowed Arizona to impose regulations and the overall groundwater mining down to a certain extent. And this is usually seen as a success story by most people to the extent that they've reduced groundwater pumping. In Texas, I think the extent to which you would see Arizona as instructive or not would depend a lot on how much you think private ownership of groundwater is the preferable way of managing the resource. The courts and the legislature have upheld the private character, groundwater as a private right. So I think it's unlikely to change in the future. So I'm not sure exactly how much Texas can take from Arizona, given that Arizona made the decision to change that right, and Texas has not. One comparison that I've noticed or difference between the two is that in Arizona, having established this complicated but effective in some ways regulatory system, it's also had the effect of minimizing, I think, conflict over groundwater rights to the extent that people, or in the sense that people are no longer fighting over each other or suing each other over individuals' use of, like, you know, your neighbors, for example, pumping groundwater out from under you, things like that. In Texas, there are still these property rights-related legal conflicts going on. And I think the contours of the rules affecting groundwater pumping, I think, are going to be sorted out a little bit piecemeal, I think, as courts make certain decisions, which personally, I think that's not the best way to create an effective governance system, but it is what it is because the issue of regulatory taking is become an important one.
So it sets a precedent and then that keeps building on itself. So Texas would have to take a very dramatic legal action like Arizona did in 1980 in order to reduce conflicts or reduce the amount of lawsuits.
Yeah, I think it's going to take longer given the current situation to get to a more sort of uniform set of rules. And not necessarily that there should be a uniform set of rules everywhere in the state, because Texas is a hugely diverse state just in terms of, you know, climate and geography and everything. But I think there are also some legal issues that it's going to take quite a while to sort out in the courts, because depending on how litigation goes, it can drag on. I think most of the conflicts in Arizona have been, over groundwater specifically, have been resolved at the administrative level rather than people suing each other. And I think maybe in Texas, it's more of the combination of both local districts and the private property issue is what has kind of fueled, I think, together in complicated ways, maybe the more, I guess, frequency of conflict, I would say, disputes.
Okay.
And I think the reason why it's potentially problematic is demands just continue to increase. And so aquifers have historically been not highly pressured, are going to increasingly see pressure. And so there's a lot of pressure on these local districts in their permitting decisions already in some cases, sort of caught between what maybe the local public is, what their values say. Typically, you know, you should be more strict about your permitting compared to what, you know, somebody who's applying for a really big permit, what they think they're entitled to. And so that's where the conflict, I think, can arise and has in the last couple years or so.
You see a big factory moving in that uses a lot of water. You see conflict between the public.
Sure,
and
or a city that is trying to just obtain access to an aquifer that's sort of beyond their jurisdiction.
Oh, okay.
So another way that an issue can be created. So it really, I think, highlights the tension between rural and urban values, I think, and the way people perceive water differently in sort of local communities compared to...
Do you see that same tension in Arizona between the rural and the urban over groundwater?
I think it was becoming more of a problem back in the 80s and early 90s when cities were starting to kind of basically do what I just described, like purchasing land in order to obtain the water rights and to pump it and pipe it. Those are called water farms by sometimes, because it's, you just sort of buy a farm and then you obtain the water rights. And then, so that was starting to happen, and that creates major tensions between, it has a big effect on, potentially on rural economies, agricultural economies. But there were rules passed kind of that sort of headed off that problem before it got to be super high profile. So I think Arizona has at least been able to avoid major rural-urban conflict for now. But I have seen some recent scholarship. I forget, there was a master's thesis I read recently that was arguing that there is a potential it's more likely that these kind of tensions could emerge again in the future as the surface water supplies in Arizona become fully allocated and the pool of available water shrinks and shrinks and shrinks, you know, increasingly over time.
Thank you so much, Zach Zug, for taking the time to explain Texas groundwater law and its comparison to Arizona water law. The comparison shows the drastic differences between the two and how much state water law can affect the outcomes of water use. I found it interesting that when an urgent environmental situation presented itself, as in the Edwards Aquifer case, the result was a top-down management strategy that is unusual to the historic Texas paradigm of bottom-up, locally focused water management that strongly defends private property rights to groundwater. I also found it interesting that private property rights led to more conflict in the courts, which of course leads to the question, who is better at solving conflict, the courts or a governmental state authority? It is a question we will continually explore in our discussions surrounding water. In upcoming episodes, we will be talking to many more people, including Lisa Shipek and Louise Mistal of the Watershed Management Group and their environmental work in water. I am delighted to have more voices from the environmental sector on Fathoming Water. We have learned a lot about how municipalities and states provide water to the people, but we haven't yet had a chance to explore the environmental risks and impacts of human water use. As well, we will be featuring highlights from the University of Arizona's Water Resources Research Center's upcoming conference on March 21st, 2016. Keep checking back for new episodes at fathomingwater.com. Fathoming Water is produced in Tucson, Arizona at KXCI Community Radio and engineered at Baby Gas Mask Records. Thank you to the University of Arizona's Water Resource Research Center for their support of Fathoming Water. Thank you to Chris Levesque for our theme music, A Walk in the Wasteland, and thank you for listening. I'm your host, Melissa Mosey.